Exception number 9185, rule number 4.
Mr. Ken Johnson, Reel 4. You were telling me about how the reality of war matched up with your, the training ideas you'd been involved in.
Yes, because the reality of war is that however much one simulates noise and danger in training, and indeed the use of live bullets, which go, of course, over your head, and you know, they always ricochet forward, when you come down to the actuality, there is this terrible fear in the pit of your stomach, which, of course, can also affect one's decisions a great deal. And people do things which they would never expect themselves to be capable of doing. But at the same time, the type of personality that is expressed in the training, you get very near to it, I found, very near to it indeed, particularly on the point of exhaustion. Of course, in the theatre of war, there is total commitment. You're in Burma. In the training situation, you can telephone home. And there lies a great difference indeed. There's no question about that. But of course, you know, whether people tell the truth or whether people try and bullshit their way out of things, or whether people are true to themselves, it really does come out very much in training, because there are a whole series of incidents. Whereas, from a wartime point of view, we're all under the cloak of confusion, because confusion in war is rife. And it's the confusion which everybody feels. And so, in the training, there is strangely less confusion. And in the wartime, in the action, there is a great deal of confusion. And that, of course, leads to a great deal of unrelated action, of people you know, doing something which at the moment saves themselves or their companions, which may not even be part of their real character.
Which battalion did you join in Burma?
Well, I went to the Gold Coast People First, and I was then I was with the 82nd Division Reconnaissance Corps, who were, a lot of them Rhodesian officers who were excellent and very, very well liked by the African troops. And of course, during those experiences, I remember cleaning out a church with a young man called Booth, who was a second lieutenant. And we cleaned the church out because the Japanese had used it for a stable. And he was one of the Booth family of the Salvation Army. And I remember even in scouting in Henzada down in Burma, starting a scout troop amongst the villagers while I was stationed in that area. And then at the very end of the campaign, I went down the Arakan with the 81st. And in fact, I went on a night patrol which joined the 81st and the 82nd Division together, which I think was later reported at the War Office. And
what happened on that occasion?
Well, it was a night move where we had to join the two divisions together, and we hadn't got to engage in fire if possible. And one made great detours around these villages where the prairie dogs were out and the fires were burning, and you had to keep well away. Of course, a lot of the Burmese villagers were like a crowd at Wimbledon. They looked to the right and they looked to the left. It was the Japanese, then it was you, and then the Japanese, it was you. And they sold their dogs, or chickens they called them, they're really dogs, to whoever happened to be in the village. But that night movement was perhaps the, you know, that was an exercise I will remember through the night, and joining until we found and encountering Japanese. One chap came out of a hedge and said good evening to me, just as though he was meeting me in Oxford Street in London. And but then he dived back in the hedge again. The Japanese bodies that one came across had very often booby traps underneath them. They did booby trap their own wounded. And I got a sword from a Japanese who surrendered, which I've sent to the museum. the DLR Museum. And so really, you know, one saw there, for instance, one night, it was the night was January 11th in that year, I remember I had come to take over a position, and the officer was in the dugout. We used to dig deep and surround them with wood, and he was with a wireless operator, and I was on the top of the dugout in the loose soil with the sergeant. And the Japanese guns, they fired boom boom, and there were three positions. They would fire, they would bring them up during the night along the tracks, and then start firing, and they'd say three positions, A, B, and yourself. We were on, say, C. They'd fire boom boom, you hit the, you hear the shell, and then it'd go on to A, and then B, and then C, and there would be about 5 minutes before it got round to you. And then suddenly they changed, and they started with us first, and caught the sergeant and I out, and he was blown up into little pieces, and I was thrown right down a hillside and landed in a hole with an African who was lying with his rifle and the bayonet on the end, crouching. I just missed his bayonet. So there were plenty of those experiences.
It's a strange question. It's probably difficult for you to say, but you'd obviously stood out as an instructor. Do you think you stood out in any way as an officer? Do you think your preeminence that you'd achieved as an instructor was reflected in any sort of preeminence as an officer?
Well, that is a very good question. I wasn't the instructor, the sort of what we're going on with now, barking. I love to do what they did. I mean, when they did the assault courses, I went round with every one of them. If they went round nine times in the day, through the rivers, over the barbed wire, around the hill, down the other side, and I did everything and just changed my clothes sometimes and went on and on with them. I love to participate with those whom I was attempting to lead. Now, the question of whether the instructor and the officer, yes, I think so, because the officer's first job is to care for his men and get them into position in a proper state to fight. And so in that, I was thoroughly capable of that. Yes, I think so, because basically, you know, by character, I'm not a person of detail. And instructing somebody on a gun or a weapon, or even on some specific map reading, isn't my forte, really.
Could you tell me now about the work you did at the end of the war, involved in welfare and putting on shows? Could you explain how you got into that in the army?
Well, I know we were in one location after Prome, where I was really, I suppose, acting as the lieutenant colonel. I mean, I was not given that rank because a regular was produced, and that often happened, to take over the battalion. But for a time, I was running this battalion.
What was the name of the battalion? We better get
a Gold Coast Regiment. And it was there that I was doing this work I mentioned about helping with the scout troops and the community and getting the church going, etc. And so then I got this call to go to the headquarters down at Jobu Reservoir, which was near Rangoon. There was a plan afoot for the attack on Rangoon earlier to have taken place, but and then for the action to be carried on with seaward landings, but it did not happen. And we came down gradually towards Rangoon, and as I say, finally it was a sort of stalemate position. I remember one night, incidentally, with those Africans, where the Japanese were in the hills and beyond, and in many cases had gone, and the Africans built a huge fire, and they danced in their natural state, many of them, without a stitch on, and they danced and they sang and they shook their fists towards the hills. And that was a tremendous experience. Because, of course, we have to remember that India had come to the aid of Africa, but Africa had never been to the aid of India, and that here were the Africans helping to rid the enemy of King Georgie, as they called him. And they were very proud about it.
How did you get on with your African
troops? Oh, marvellous. They called me Major Booga Booga. And I loved it because, you see, I used to get my instructions across in a series of actions and play acting, and they loved that. I mean, rather terrifying to be in the bush with a whole lot of guys who you can hardly converse with properly, and you send a man down a track and you tell him by pointing with his eye and your finger, at your eye and your finger, you go look, and he goes down because there may be Japanese there, and there's a rustle in the bushes and he's back again. You say, "You see Japani?" He say, "I go look 'em." And you think, "Yes, yes, for God's sake, what? I go see 'em." And you just about, you know, all your hair rises on the back of your neck. And he says, "No, but I no find them." I go see 'em, I go look 'em, but I no find 'em.
Did you ever try and learn the local, the
not really.
African dialect?
No, it's too difficult, and they had too many, you know. The Hausamen from the Nigerians were the big, strong, tall kind of soldier material, and one was sometimes with them, and then sometimes with others who were of different tribes. But to go back to the Jobu Reservoir, I was asked to go there, or told to go there, to meet the general who was... already stationed there, and all the caravans were there in position. It was the headquarters, and he was General Sir Hugh Stockwell, and of course he had been commandant at the Staff College and tremendous distinction, and he said to me, "I'm going to make you what is called Dadors." Well, it was the Deputy Assistant Director of Army Welfare Services. You know how they put these deputies, I suppose the Director of Army Welfare Services would be somewhere in SEAC, and the Assistant Director of Army Welfare Services was possibly at headquarters too, but I was on the spot. I was the Deputy Assistant Director. Anyway, I had a small Oster craft which I used sometimes. The Canadian pilot, I remember, used to frighten me by pretending the engine had cut out over the jungle. It caused me all sorts of embarrassment when he did that sort of thing. And then anyway, I started up an African concert party and a Chinese one from the Burmese.
How would
the Chinese.
How would you go about doing that?
Well, first of all, I sent round to the units asking for people to volunteer, and I remember I'd been to one unit and to a mess party, and remembered a young guy who was only about 22, but he was almost bald, who had done a very good impersonation of Churchill, and I sent for him. He was building rafts on the Irrawaddy at the time, and he came down. He had these awful suede shoes, and he used to salute with his fingers so he could see you through his fingers. And he joined the concert party. And I remember when I left to come home, I wrote a recommendation out for him to stay on and join the command sort of concert party and have a job at Radio Rangoon, where I used to do broadcast. And when the war ended, he got an immediate grant to radar, and met his wife at Litchfield Repertory, and I was on a programme, This Is Your Life, telling the story for him as Lionel Jeffries, who was a very famous actor, and that all arose through those days. Charlie Lyon, I had in the dance band. I last heard of him in charge of customs and excise in the Bristol area, and there were others, and so I got them together. We got our lights and the bamboo stage. We travelled about and we put shows on. The Chinese, I got them, of course, with their dragons, and they were mostly round Rangoon. And the Africans, they had their own version of the concert party with their own African songs. So we played at the Fish Theatre in Rangoon. I remember there was a famous comedian there who used to say to people who interrupted, came in, "You're late." And he was entertaining at the Fish Theatre in Rangoon. He called out to this young officer who came in, "You're late, sir," he said. And so the officer stopped and said, "Yes, and you're late too, 2 years too late." That wasn't very fair. Anyway, we played at the Fish Theatre Rangoon. That was a great date.
Did you do anything else for the... I mean, it was all in the welfare service, or were you just purely in charge of the shows?
Oh, it was purely, really, that. I mean, it was... they were all waiting. It was the end of the campaign. It was in South Burma, and it was a contribution to, you know, to provide them with entertainment, and it kept me busy for the final 6 months or so, and I did quite a lot of talks and entertainment over Radio Rangoon. So I'd always been in the army using what talents one had in entertaining, and I remember even in Iceland, in when we were there in Radio Reykjavik, here was this officer whom I'd met in hospital when I'd been in there after that performance in the blizzard I told you about, and I got frostbite. And I'd met him there, and he was a Shakespearean actor, and he'd been put off from the Prince of Wales after the action in the Atlantic, wounded. And I took him to the onto a programme on Radio Reykjavik, and he was Esmond Knight, who still, I'm sure, acting, and a very fine Shakespearean actor. And I got him going, because he was blinded, you see. He lost his eyes in that action, and I got him the first time in a station... in a radio station performing sightless.
Did you just have a programme on Radio Rangoon which you would pick the acts for and then, or how did it actually work on Radio Rangoon?
Well, mostly giving talks and you know,
would you give the talks?
Yes,
well?
Give the talks and fill in time and have some idea for a programme. And of course later on in life I did have this experience because I was with Associated Rediffusion and started their first sport programmes and became head of sport there.
When were you demobbed?
Now then, I don't think I ever got the suit, as they used to call it. I came back in 1946, I think. Yeah. 1946.
Thank you very much.